they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole we found. And I was thinking,
hi, this is Nico. You're listening to My Dad Will Follow, also known as the White Rabbit and James Jardine on the one and only Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Buckle up and enjoy.
Deep into this pool.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. And I am privileged to say welcome to episode 600 of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is being streamed live out onto your LinkedIn, out into YouTube, for those of you that want to catch up, get with us and kind of see what's up. We're testing the limits of the platform that we've got. So for those of you guys that don't know, I've been a little bit ago switched over to a platform called Boomcaster for my for the podcast, and we've had successfully four guests, James and I. We now have seven people total. So we're gonna stretch the limits of this thing. It's gonna be so much fun, and I can't wait to get going. I am gonna go around the horn here and just quickly introduce everybody. Then we'll just kind of do. I don't know what we're gonna do. We're gonna get going. I'm gonna introduce something. We're just gonna keep going. All right. Let's see. Let's start with the man that's been hanging out with me for quite a while. That would be you, James. Say hello.
Hello, everyone. Glad to be here. Looking forward to 600 here. This is going to be great, huh?
All right. And next to James, Eric Block returning.
Hey, it's wonderful to be back. I'm glad I didn't make so much of a fool of myself last time that you wanted me back on here.
Yeah, I figured you could use the exposure. Nobody knows who you are, man. So I figured I'd use the podcast to give you some exposure.
I appreciate you helping the up and comers and the.
That's right. Yeah, you know,
you're platforming.
I absolutely. And speaking of platforming, that lovely voice you hear, in case you're not watching this, is Anton Chervakin. Welcome back, Anton.
Thank you very much. I promise not to cause too much mischief this time.
Why?
Yeah.
Oh. Excellent question.
That's a requirement. I think that's the reason I brought you on the show.
I was going to say, that's why you brought him, isn't it?
That's right. Returning perennial guest host and whatnot, Mr. Jim Tiller. Hey, buddy.
Hey, Raph. How's it going, man? 600. Wow, man.
600. And Jim said that maybe for 600, there might be a creature that pops out of that door behind him.
Keep your eye open. Right, was it right?
Right there. Yeah, yeah. Maybe. Oh, geez. If you do that and something and like that door opens, I'm just gonna walk. You're gonna see me just leave. I'm done. All right. Let's see. And over to Mr. Jeff Collins over there. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Raph. Thanks for having me on. It's big excitement to be on episode 600. This is exciting. I can't wait for episode 1,000.
Let's not put that cart that far ahead of the horse. And out and back, hopefully you can hear us now, but you're on mute. Mr. James Beeson. James, are you there? Nope. Oh. All right.
Nope, he's not there. He's off mute, though.
Wait, he's off mute. Definitely off mute. Nope.
Say something.
Nothing yet. All right. We'll get him. We'll get him back. We'll get him back. We'll send the audio tech over.
By teleport?
Well, by teleport. Yeah, we'll see how that
goes. He's remote. Get him to install TeamViewer, and maybe you can help him out live on here.
That is
a screen share. Yeah, it'd be fantastic.
If we're installing, why don't we install just some ransomware and maybe charge him money? I think it's better use of our time, frankly.
Wow. Anton's advocating for the Anton is advocating.
But it's a benign use case. It's all in the intent. If the intent is benign, it's not a crime, right?
Yeah. All right.
We call that research, well, listen, guys, Anton.
You got to do it in air quotes, research. All right, so episode 600 is going to be a double live. Oh, there goes James again. He'll come back. Is going to be a 2-hour live set here. I have no idea how I'm going to cut this up and slice this up into shows yet, but or I may just release the entire 2 hours and see what happens. How many people actually get through it all? All right, but I've assembled this group of snarky bastards and some others that will jump on in the second hour to join us to really kind of, I don't know. I thought we'd talk about like what the hell's wrong with us? There was a talk at B-Sides in New Orleans yesterday, and it was very interesting. And it was called "What's Wrong with Security?" And my answer to that is, oh, so many things. But it's interesting. I feel like we've been doing this since episode one, guys. So that you guys, those of you that listened, episode one started with the debate over should a CISO be a bottom up, up and comer, right? Techie that kind of grew his way up. Or her way up, I suppose, because we have those now. Should it be an executive that learns enough about security to be effective, but has to hire a team? And that debate raged and raged and raged, and it was very interesting. However, I don't know that we ever settled it. And now that we are many years later in this, right? We are 600 episodes away from that. I don't know that has been settled. What do you guys think? Anybody want to start with that? Have we, is that debate settled? Does anybody have an opinion on this?
I have a boring opinion. Do you want me to start with?
I like boring opinion. Non-controversial might be a good place to start.
Yeah. Non-controversial. Definitely seen successes down both paths. So why is there a debate? Yes to both.
So let me throw this at you then, if because this is kind of where the modern the today version of this started. With all of these, with these recent CISOs that have been tagged with by certain three-letter government agencies and regulators as having done something wrong. I find it interesting that as security has been pounding the table saying, hey, we need, you know, a seat at the big kids table. We need to be an executive. We need to be this. We need to be that. And suddenly we are. And there's this huge panic going around about, well, oh, but what do you mean I have to understand materiality and business and have a lawyer and all these things. Nobody told me this, right? And so I'm thinking, okay, but if you were one of those bottom up folks and you find yourself in a CISO seat, this is not the wake up call you want. By the way, James, Mr. Beeson, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can.
Hey, he's back. All right.
Hey. I was struggling with the old AirPods or whatever.
That's okay. You know, mine did that to me as well. I had to disconnect and reconnect twice before anybody could hear me. So that's good. All right. Well, welcome, James. Can I start with you? Do you have a because Anton's opinion truly was boring. You have an opinion on this?
I came in at the tail end of the question. So what was the question?
So the question was this podcast started 600 episodes ago with the question of is a what makes a better CISO, a technologist that has worked his or her way up into an executive seat, or a business executive that has worked a CIO, a CTO type that has worked their way and taken a lateral role, say, into a CISO role.
Well, my viewpoint's simple. The answer is yes. You know, both. Today the world, the fact is you need to have some level of, my view is you need to have some level of technical capability, because otherwise you're going to get snowed over by the infrastructure team, the development teams, and everybody in technology. But at this point, to be a CISO at any size company, you better understand the language of business. And my view is that's economics and it's finance. And I don't care if you're running an ice cream stand or a $400 billion corporation, the language of business is finance and accounting. And you better understand that so that you can learn to translate between the two, which is a big chunk of what the CISO's role is at this point. There's my view.
That's fair. I mean, that's definitely a little bit less boring than Anton's point of view.
So, Ralph, I've got a little bit different point of view here.
All right.
So, both James and Anton are certainly more like Switzerland than I am. So, that's always positive. I will answer somewhat like them, that the reality is I think both can be important and both can be successful in a CISO role. The reality is, and I think one of the biggest things that CISOs lack that make them fail, and this is executives across the board, but much more so in the CISO, is they lack an inquisitive nature. And I think this is the piece, whether you start from the bottom or you start from the top, if you're not inquisitive, that's where we all get burned. People at the bottom can certainly lack. You know, if you spend your career looking at screens and typing in commands, you may not be inquisitive in any way, shape, or form. You're used to running a playbook. You've gone up from the bottom, and now you're a CISO because you were either the last person standing or, you know, someone just drew your card that day. But on the same token, the same thing happens from an executive level. You know, you could have been a director of IT. You could have been a VP of IT. You could have been a CFO for that matter. And now you become a CISO. But I think in all of those, it's that inquisitive nature that has caused so many burns. Like we see so many organizations get compromised, and they get compromised because someone just didn't ask a question. Like something as simple, you know, I was involved with an engagement in the last couple of weeks where the environment was breached, and it was breached simply because they never had authentication on an API. None at all. Just skip that step. Why? Because the two resources were in exactly the same area. They were both in the same cloud. They were both in the same VPC. And that's why they didn't have authentication, because they didn't think anything could get in there. Well, the reality is it did. And, you know, when you have things like that, that's where we see that lack of inquisition and that lack of actually looking at it and just asking that question. Like, hey, so we have this API, but is it actually secure? And I don't think that matters if you came from the bottom up or the top down. You have to have that capability.
Okay.
Can I add to Jeff? First of all, I just want to back Jeff up and say I actually 100% agree with the, you have to have an inquisitive nature about you, you know, no matter what. But if I may add to that is very early on, I used to say there's like this pendulum swing that we would see is organized to be very risk focused. And then it was like, well, we got to do something about it. So it became kind of like, let's focus. The industry would follow and become very technology oriented. So I want to kind of raise two points. One is the timing of when you asked that question nearly 15 years ago versus today, right? So the world's changed dramatically. And through that change, that pendulum kept swinging back and forth. You know, maybe it was with early standards and regulations like BSI 7799 and HIPAA and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we saw the evolution of technology and then pushing into different regulations and coming back, or excuse me, more deep technology at cloud. And it's like, well, how are we going to manage the risk and compliance of cloud? Went back. Well, the last, in my opinion, last decade has become very stitched up over here on security. So CISOs have been really seen as like, you need to come from technology, right? You know what I mean? And so yeah, there's fair. Been this gravitating force to be more technically oriented. And to James's point that, you know, you have to have a technical knowledge. What's happened is, in my, strictly my opinion, what happened now is that regulations and laws are now all of a sudden just ratcheted up overnight, seemingly. And all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I was coming at this from a technical scenario and I was trying to get into business. Now that pendulum swung completely over and now I'm being held accountable at a much higher business and legal level. And I think it's kind of shocked the system a little bit. So I think recently it's been very much about, maybe a balance, but I would say a little bit more lean more toward technology over the last several years than it has been. And then now it's like the shock to the system is like, well, wait a second, I thought this was a technical job and it's not. It's not a primary piece, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Eric,
it's interesting, yes, because I've come up through kind of startup land. I've been heads of security for startups. I've been in senior leadership positions at big giant companies. And I guess, I'd probably back up James and Anton's point. Like, yes, you have to have both. If you're coming up smaller, like when I was running security at a little 100-person startup, right? Like, you have to be hands-on. You have to have the technical skills. At the same time, if you're presenting something to the CEO, even when it's a small company, you have to have some of that business language. When you start getting to bigger enterprises, you go to a public company, like to James's point, that becomes your job. You have to be able to speak the language of business like all the other C-level executives do. And if you can't, they're going to take you away. They're not going to have a seat at the table, right? They'll put somebody in there who can't speak the language of business. At the same time, like either that person, again, to James's point, they have some technical chops. They don't get snowballed by engineering and DevOps and everybody else. Or they really trust a leadership team they have around them to do that kind of filtering for them. Because I've seen it work both ways at enterprises where they bring in just an executive manager who's a manager. I've also seen them bring in people who are, technically hands-on, super smart, and managers. And I've seen them both work, and I've seen them both fail. So I think that the piece that we're kind of missing from this conversation is the CISO role doesn't happen in a void, right? You have the entire company wrapped around you, you have the company's culture, you have the other players involved. Is the chemistry right with the C-level leadership team? Is the company's culture there to make all this work? And as I'm sure you guys have seen, sometimes you go to work for an amazing company, your dream job, and the team chemistry isn't there. You hate your boss. Things go off the rail. So it's all kind of dependent on many more factors besides just the CISO's, skills or abilities. And so I kind of look at it more holistically, I guess. But at the same time, I'd back up, Connie and James's point about, yes.
I came up with a semi-scientific way to confirm it. Which part, if missing, would make you fail faster? And I think I have an answer for this, that if you are coming with a lot of board knowledge, business knowledge, everything, and you absolutely lack technical knowledge, you absolutely certainly would fail as a CISO. But if you come with no business knowledge, it would be maybe painful. You would need to learn very quickly, and you probably would fail anyway. But to me, not having the technical part is a bigger disaster.
Yeah, one comment I'd make there too is, at least in my experience, boy, it depends on the company, right? Because I've presented to a lot of different boards, and the board makeups are unique. Everybody, here's a standard package for the board. Good luck with that, because every single board I've ever talked to is pretty unique in makeup, right? And the Cigna board, right, they would throw me out of there if I went in there and started talking technical anything, right? What they want me to talk about is risk, and they want me to talk about it simply enough that they understand what the heck I'm talking about. On the other hand, with GE, actually, there was a much bigger expectation that you were going to come in and talk more about technology. So I only say that to say, to your point, Anton, you could fail either way, right? I think it depends on the culture, it depends on the makeup of the company and the board and the CEO and everybody else. It's pretty unique.
Let me ask a question really quick, and this is for Anton, but James is you as well. And Raph, if you allow me to ask this question, you might say, look, Jim, that takes us down a really boring path, right? Can we take a moment, just a little tiny moment, and say, can somebody just give me an example of what they feel is a good representation example of what a technical discussion would be? So we mean terms like, oh, you need to talk business. You need to talk technical. And I get in rooms and I'm like, somebody says something, they think they're the sharpest, pointy bit in the shed when it comes to insert technology. And I'm like, man, I know 10 times that, and I'm not technical at all in that area, right? So Anton, is it? Do you think a CISO needs to know how to write, you know, infrastructure as code, be able to review IaaS?
No. The bar I had in mind is he has the technical knowledge.
Oh, muted.
You've been muted.
Okay, so the bar I had is the non-technical is the as technical as a typical USA Today reader, like common population zero. Technical okay. skills. Zero, exactly. I had like people who can't spell idea. And I've seen people, and Sim, I cannot always spell exactly. Sim, frankly. Like Sim, don't get me started on Sim versus Kim. So this is like way bigger debate. But he can't spell ideas. Sim is a bit of a trick question. Like,
interesting. So let me ask you guys a different, slightly different question then, because, and I'll frame it this way: we have this issue where, Anton, you said if you know that the technology, but mm-hmm. you don't quite know the business, you said you'd still fail, but you might be able to learn that. I think we've got a couple of fairly good examples, and the volume is going to increase of the dangers of not knowing the business side of things.
Yes. Easy to, yeah.
Right. So
yes, 100%. I'm actually opposite and it's of not Anton like, on this one.
Yeah. And it's not like, hey, you're going to be, you know, you're going to have to work through it. No, it's like, hey, you may actually be facing jail time. Or, you know, you may be facing a personal lawsuit, or something. Because it turns out like being a company officer actually has meaning to it. Like it's not just, I want people to listen to me. It is, there's more to it, right? There's actual responsibilities around this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that expanding out past the business though, Raf? I mean, going and saying like when you start getting the legal side of things, now it's like, do you understand compliance and legal and all these other things? Is there a separation between that knowledge that we'd expect somebody to know and the business knowledge of being able to present to a board, talk to a board, that type of spot, right? Because I feel like that could be separated out as almost two different areas.
Maybe.
Yeah, I certainly think I think that's exactly right, James. And I mean, and you know,
James just went mute.
That's weird. We're having some mute issues. That's strange.
Here we are. I didn't touch anything. I don't think
that's weird.
An analogy I use all the time is, you know, kind of like a lawyer, like legal. I mean, it's a good analogy, I think, mm-hmm. for part of what our role is as a CISO, in my point of view, right? Because most of the things that are big items, you know, honestly, I'm not making the decision. I'm not the decision maker. I'm the decision advisor, like an attorney, right? And I can say to you, okay, Raf, if you plead guilty, you know, this is what's likely going to happen. If you plead no contest, this is what's likely going to happen, right? So we're more an input about the risk and the threat side than we are, in many cases, the decision maker. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of my point of view.
Interesting.
It goes back to resourcing, right? I mean, what you're saying, James, is like, hey, look, we have all this risk we want to address, and then you're advising them, hey, these are the risks I think we should address and why, and then somebody comes in from the board or finance, and they draw a line somewhere on your list, and you get to work on all the things above that, right? And all the things below that, you're not, but you've tried your best to pitch it of why they should, right? But this is an exercise that happens every year for everybody. You go through that participation. Somebody else draws that line. It's not you. I mean, you're not writing the check, right? So
exactly. That's exactly my point, Eric. And you know, usually what I do, I make it very simple, right? We got five big risks. That's it. You know, availability. That's one. And you know what? The board understands what that means. If the systems are down or a process isn't working, that's not good for the company, right? The second one is unauthorized access. I don't care if it's internal, external, accidental, or malicious. If it's access to information and somebody's got it that shouldn't have, that's bad. And they understand what that means. The third one is data loss or data leakage. Again, the one that gets all the headlines largely. They understand what it means if we lose a piece of data. Again, doesn't matter if it's malicious or or accidental. The fourth one is about resiliency. Can we recover an operation, a set of processes or systems? And they also understand what that means. And that's really a resiliency discussion. And then the final one is regulatory non-compliance, because every single business is under some level of regulatory requirements that varies depending on what the business you're in, but that they understand what that means and they'll understand it for their business. And that's the way I frame the risks to the board.
Is that a culture change that we have to get through though? Because historically security has been known as the no, right? Like people are looking at security to make that decision, not guide the decision. And I'm with you 100%. Like that's where we should belong, right? We are the guide. Somebody else makes that. I use the example of software delivery, right? Like I'm not the one to say you can't push that software. I'm the one to say, here's the risk of you pushing that software. But somebody that has a larger purview makes that decision of should this go? But we've got that history of, oh, we're the blockers. We're the no. You know, so there's that expectation. How do we get that back and say, no, that we really don't want to be that. We are that guide of, I want to give you the risks and help you understand it. But as a group, you're making that decision, not a sole person making that decision.
Well, I think a lot of that, James, is because it's a lot easier to say no than to actually walk into a board meeting like James talked about and actually walk through with a really well-defined, you know, 5-10 areas of risk for the organization and accurately talk through them. I think it's just a lot easier just to say no. And I think that's why we see a lot of no. And I think that's why security in many regards becomes the no team, because it's the easier answer. I'm not saying it's right, but oftentimes that's why it becomes that way.
I kind of have a slightly contrarian view to that where, ooh, sorry, spicy.
Go.
where the, We've kind of been, originally we were known as the Department of No, because that's literally all we did, right? No, you can't do anything. And now, if you take the approach, like a modern approach of like Jason Channon is paved road, right? If you want to give them one way to do things, that's right. This is the right, secure, default way to do things, right? At the same time, to draw an analogy to Perl, which is still my favorite language, there are 1,000 ways to do the exact same thing, right? How do you do that? And I think that's where security teams are still in the business of saying no. We're like, hey, I want to go do this thing, you know, one-off way to do this, or I have some new way to do this, or I want to do it that way. And you're like, no, I have a paved road for you to follow that everyone here follows. All engineering follows the same paved road. All of, you know, application security, whatever. You're following this paved road. We made you by design, just like you would any other engineering process or any other process you have in your company. Hence why we do say no a lot today. But it's more of like, yes, you can do this, but here's the paved road I want you to do it on. You know, we still see that people hear it as no, because they still go out and do the thing anyways, right? Which is why we all have jobs. It's the same thing like shadow IT. Can I have this app? No. Okay, personal credit card. Boop. And they're using it anyways. And so as long as we keep putting these guardrails in place, we have the best intentions. Like, we're always going to have that 80-20, 90-10 rule, whatever it is, where some people will accept it and do it. Some people will do the things they want to anyways. But, you know, most of them are still going to ask. And that's where our no's or yes, but comes in.
I couldn't possibly agree more, Eric. And I think it ties into what Jeff said earlier about, you know, sort of having that imagination and having that sort of ability. But I think somewhere we may have lost that sense of, understanding the intent, right? So we sort of say we're really kind of focused on the steps, that path in many ways. Anything outside of that must be bad, as opposed to understanding what is the actual intent, objective goal, and exploring the various ways to get there that avoid the no and enhance the ability to kind of support the business or support what needs to get done or reduce risk, how they are envisioning it or meeting that compliance objective, right? So I think it comes down to that willingness to fail fast on something that you may have, you know, wrapped your entire identity around for that company and go, well, maybe that wasn't a good idea. And I think there's a lot of resistance to that. This is my style. This is my standard approach to doing security. And I've done it 15 times at 10 different companies. I'm going to do it this way. Yeah. And I think we need to break away from that a little bit and say, okay, it's okay to be wrong if it means that the ultimate intent is getting us to where we need to be. And I think it's a really, really accurate point, Eric.
I think we'll get better, right? We keep improving through our failures. At the same time, you know, to kind of bring this back to you know, James' earlier point, like this is where, like, if you're at a bigger company, the CISO really needs to make sure that they understand, you know, what are the business outcomes we're trying to achieve this year? How do I align my security program with those business objectives? So, like, to your point, we're delivering on the things that they want to do. If engineering has to do X, Y, and Z this year, we should be make sure we have an initiative stood up so they can do this, right? If they're off doing something we don't know about, or you know, something like that, or they're doing things that are outside our guardrails or whatever, we didn't know about it. Like, either something happened and the whole company pivot left us out, or we didn't align our security, you know, objectives for this year with the company, which goes back to the CISO being able to speak the language of the business.
Yeah, and the one other point I'd make is just, you know, to some degree, the devil's in the detail. You're 100% right. Devil's in the detail. A way that you can mitigate that, in my point of view, and this is what we've tried to do, and again, I'm no fool. We're not perfect at it for sure, but you got to get the measurement in the right place. That's where some of the no stuff comes from, right? If you put the measurement on the developer or on the infrastructure leader, you set the rules and guidelines and say, we're measuring you, and part of your bonus and your raise and your ability to move forward, you have to meet these measurements, then it isn't security saying no. You know, so it's some of it is just driving the behavior change, and that gets down to the age old, I think a GE tagline was very frequent in GE, which is if you're not measuring it, you can't change it.
Yep.
But yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about what you just said, James, is, you know, this is the melding of a tactical conversation and a strategic conversation. You know, when Eric talked about, you know, saying no because, you know, your developers want to do something and you push them down this individual guardrailed path, that's a very tactical no. And that becomes a very tactical yes. You know, here's how you can, you know, you can't do it this way, but you can do it this way. I think one of the things that I often see, and this was my point earlier when I said, you know, a lot of teams say no instead of saying yes in a strategic realm, is they don't meld those two very well. You know, when you have a tactical conversation, in the same vein, you also have to be having a strategic conversation. Because oftentimes, if you don't have that strategic conversation, you can also hamstring the business. You know, if you're reaching out to your development team and you're telling them no and yes, there's often budgetary constraints there. But if you're not accurately telling the C-suite and the board what that actually means to the business, at the end of the day, the development team's not going to get their budget. You're not going to get your budget. The IT operations team and cloud ops isn't going to get their budget. And at the end of the day, no one wins. And then you just became the entity that said no. And even though you did say yes, it was a but yes. And in reality, in the business, especially at a tactical level, it was just a no. And I think we always have to think through that of, you know, how do we meld that tactical and that strategic conversation so that we're always pushing upward and providing that value to the business and ultimately driving budget to allow these pieces to grow and build.
100%.
Can I take this in a slightly different direction, guys? Maybe I want to pivot because that makes sense to me. But when I look at this role, the leadership of the security organization, right, James, you were talking about making sure that you have enough knowledge to know when you're not being kind of snowed over. I would argue that's probably a good role of a lieutenant or like a deputy, right? That to have somebody that's got the technical knowledge to know the ins and outs, the limitations. Because one of the things that I learned, you know, working in GE with you is that leadership is probably the leadership part of any leadership job is probably the hardest. And that's not to be flippant. That's literally like the leading part is the hardest. The thing that you're leading, oftentimes you can figure out, because what did we do at GE? Like, managers rotated through various departments, right? You do your rotation in the exchange team. Then you went and did help desk for a while. Then you went and ran systems for a minute. Then you became the NetOps person. But it was all at a mid management level. You were never the VP of or the C level of, yeah. Right? So that's kind of where my head's at when I think, boy, if I were to go take that path, if I were to go rewind and take that path, I'd want to take the path of understanding how business runs, being a business level executive that with enough knowledge that I know how to hire the people that will be my deputies underneath me that would have the knowledge I need that could then rotate and do all those things. Because I think the business side of this job, the leadership side of this job is really hard for us. I could be completely wrong on this, and you guys probably tell me, or people listening will tell me. The reason for that is we're built a little differently mentally and emotionally, and we're built to sort of see problems in the abstract. We can solve things. We can deep dive on things. What we're not super good at is looking at like the broad alternatives. What I mean by that is like, if we're saying, hey, there's a project in place, and this is something I was a part of, right? There's a project in place. It's to do, put 20 new apps in, and they're going to attach the database and have our customer information. In our brains, it's automatically, okay, data needs to be protected. This needs to happen. This needs to happen. This needs to happen. And like the CIOs that I worked for that were really good would sort of see that piece potentially, but also like all the like, hey, how much does this cost? How much business risk does this introduce? Like, what is this? How much revenue is this bringing in? Is this like, what is this for our brand? And then you got to start thinking, I think, about the pieces of that role that are, that I think are super important and nobody really talks about a lot. And that is like the politics of being a CISO. Right. And I don't know, Mr. Beeson, we never had any politics when we were at GE. So that was but does that make sense to you? Am I making sense? Like, or am I kind of out in left field here? Am I by myself? Anybody?
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right. The most important piece of the job in our role is the leadership role, in my opinion. I couldn't agree with that more. And it's even more so the case today because you have a hugely broad base of stakeholders all over the place, right? And one of the hardest pieces of our jobs, frankly, at this point, is attracting and then retaining talent that can do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who said, somebody said earlier, you can absolutely surround yourself with whatever, you know, are not your strengths. I mean, I'm a big believer in the whole, you know, play to your strengths. Don't waste a bunch of time on stuff you suck at, pardon my friend. And go hire people that are good at that stuff, right? And you know, use a diverse team, right? Diverse in terms of skills and capabilities. If I'm good at infrastructure, but I don't know anything about development, go hire somebody. But you're right, leadership is one of the most important jobs I think any CISO has. And I don't think it matters whether that's a giant corporation like Cigna or a 20-person startup.
Yeah. All right. So that makes me feel better that maybe I'm not completely clueless on this. The other part of this that I'm curious about is with actually getting an executive, an officer title, like a true officer title, right? Not just because chief information security officer doesn't always mean you're actually an officer of the company, right? But like when you actually have an officer of the company title and you have those responsibilities, do you guys, I mean, there's an entirely new layer of oh crap that goes with this when I look at it that I think 99 out of 100 people think, yeah, how hard can that stuff be? And I sat down with somebody a couple weeks ago and we sort of went through the things that she learned going into an officer seat and what that meant. And I got to tell you guys, I've been doing this for a long time, like you guys. I had most of them were foreign to me. Reporting, you know, how do you actually report? Well, she was talking about reporting risk to the chief risk officer and the register they keep and the things that you have to sign and attestations and these various things. And I'm like, I didn't know this existed. It's like, wow, I'm actually kind of glad I don't live in this world because I would be absolutely clueless when it comes to that. For the group here, then the question is that stuff that you think is like all the other the officer stuff, right? Is that stuff you think you'd be comfortable learning on the fly?
Can I make one comment here too before you answer, Eric? I didn't mean to cut you off there. With Tim Brown, right? I know Tim. If you look at his case, you know what? He wasn't officially an officer, but you know what? It made no difference whatsoever.
Really?
It made no difference whatsoever because the FTC or the whoever it is that is, you know, your regulator will see you as that level, that officer, regardless of whether or not you've got the title. Tim Brown's dealing with that now.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I'm glad you brought that up, James. And if you don't mind, really, Raph, I think it's less about, you know, learning on the fly, but coming to grips with what it means, right? You can do it, you can figure it out, but coming to grips with what it actually means to the level of responsibility that you're taking. I think for those people out there who might be listening that are kind of moving up the ranks in their own sort of professional career, it's like when the first time you really take on HR responsibilities for a team, right? All of a sudden, you're exposed to these different policies and things of that nature. Like, oh, you kind of you thump through that. But the level of exposure for you as a professional, as an individual, is not great. It's just like, wow, there's a whole other set of things I got to think about. And you name it, it's in there. And then imagine as you keep going closer to the heart of the business, those things expand and they become far more, let's just say, hot to touch, right? Yeah. And they become super complicated. So you spend actually a lot of your time dealing with what it means to sign reports and submit certification letters and put your name on things. And James, you're dead spot on, right? Just because we put the word O, the letter O in CISO doesn't mean it just means, hey, you're head of security. And if you're in a public company, that carries weight. Just because you're not an officer doesn't mean it doesn't carry weight for investors, which is sort of the example that you were leaning into. Sorry, Eric, over to you, man.
No, I was just going to say yes. I mean, that was my only comment. Yes, it's kind of how people learn today. I mean, I know there are classes and stuff like that you can take. You can go get certified, whatever. But I mean, back in the day, you had to work your way up from the trenches. Like you worked your way up. You started as head of security or director of security at some small company, and you got exposed to, oh crap, I've got three reports. All of a sudden, now I have to do HR stuff. Like I have to do all this other stuff too. And as you work your way up, those responsibilities that just continue to grow, right? As you get to a bigger company, it becomes public. All of a sudden, there's more responsibilities you have to have. And it's like anything else. Like you're not going to, hire a CEO for a 100,000-person company. You're not going to hire that CEO from like a 10-person startup, right? You want somebody else who already has those skills, who's worked their way up and learned all those lessons, learned the hard lessons, as I'm sure some of you guys can relate. And to know how to avoid some of those pitfalls, you kind of already have those skills to navigate kind of the corporate landscape. But at the same time, looking at all of our ages here, like we came to the age where you had to kind of go through the school of hard knocks. You had to learn it as you went up the ladder. And because there was no, certification or class you could take for this like there are today. So.
What do you mean, Eric? I'm only 19 years old, man.
I just turned 22 yesterday. What are you talking about?
Hey guys, so we've got this. When it changed topics at the top of the hour here, and I know some of you guys are departing, and we'll get a couple of fresh guests jumping in. And I don't know where the last 15 minutes has gone. Honestly, this is shocking. I love these conversations. I could just do this all night. But let's put this one to bed. Let's wrap this up and put a bow on it. So if you're not a CISO today and you want to be one. We're going to go around the horn once. Uh-oh. Anton's going to disappear on me. Uh-oh. We're going to go around the horn once, and I'll kind of point at you, and give me the essential set of skills and things the three things to know, and then like two things to worry about or something like that. And I'm gonna start with Collins because you've talked the least.
I've talked the least. Wow. No prayer. That's a big day for me. Can I start with that the greatest skill of a CISO is to be really good at the game of Russian roulette?
That's a little scary, but okay.
I mean, but really, I mean, when you think about a CISO, I make that comment about Russian roulette, But oftentimes that's how the cards lay. And I think it's something that everybody should always think about. You can do your job great every single day and do your job well, and you still get shot at the end of the day. And so, you know, I make that joke, but that's a certain reality. You know, and I would state that the things that, you know, you need to have as skills certainly vary by the company. If you're in a company that has a really bad culture and really poor management, it's a very different set of skills. Oftentimes your skills end up in a survival camp. If you're in a strategic company that's growing rapidly, you know, your skills are a lot of what we've talked about before. They're very political, leadership skills, the ability to interact with others, and especially interact with the C-suite as well as a board. I think those are all important components. From the realm of things to watch out for, I would argue that in kind of two ways. Everybody one is, I'd go back to my comment I had before. You know, you have to be inquisitive. If you're inquisitive, if you ask the questions, if you work with your team, if you work with the constituents within your organization, your gotchas become much less. You know, if you spend time with a dev team and you really help them operate, you know, I watch in so many organizations create teams like DevSecOps that don't really exist, but they created them that way because either security became a bottleneck or security wanted to be involved in the dev process, and they didn't get involved as effectively as they should. And I think as those teams build those, you know, those processes, those methodologies, I think being inquisitive, asking the questions, understanding what's going on, having a technical mindset are all infinitely required to be successful in the role. It's a very different role than it was 20 years ago, or geez, when I started in this industry 25 years ago. I'm like James, though. I started when I was -4. So I'm also 21, or I guess in James's case, he was 19.
Yeah, I guess I didn't make myself old enough to drink. That's the problem. I just realized that.
Yeah. Well, since you spoke up, Mr. Veason, how about you go next?
Sure. Well, I mean, I said the one thing that I would say, and then I've got a handful of things I'd say. The one thing is you got to understand the language of business. I mean, I tell interns that, and frankly, I don't even think it matters what job you are. As you get more senior in the role, you better understand the language of business. So that's the main thing. What I would say about, you know, trying to get to the CISO role, first of all, there's very few things you can control, really, at the end of the day. Integrity and attitude are two of them. And you have to have 100% integrity. And the attitude goes to, it goes to being inquisitive and, you know, those sorts of things. There's only 168 hours in a week. I used to tell my kids that all the time. You can't change that. But what you can do is make sure you're dividing your time up appropriately across the number of hours you're going to give back to the company. Trust is the absolute most important word in a CISO role. You've got to have trust with the board, with the senior leadership, with the CIO or whoever you work for. Diversity, I mentioned earlier, brings the best solutions every time. Diversity of all kinds. Know your strengths and weaknesses. I touched on that. Simple is better. Be a storyteller. That's what you need to be able to get your point across. Courage is super important in this role. And I also think if you're not at the CISO role, you should be trying to work yourself out of a job, not build an empire. And you will be more successful with that. Finally, humility and empathy are also really, I think, important to the CISO role. And, you know, as our CEO says all the time, you know, seek first to understand before seeking to be understood. And I really like that. I'll stop there.
I like that. All right. Mr. Block.
Well, let's see. I agree with everything James said around the skills and abilities you have to have. You know, I touch on probably a touch of resiliency. I mean, CISOs, I mean, I describe them as kind of turd umbrellas. They hold the umbrella up and everything has to hit it and roll off them to shield the team. So you have to have that resiliency. At the same time, resiliency is on the opposite end from empathy. So if you're super empathetic, you're probably not really resilient. If you're super resilient, you're probably not really empathetic. So I am like, I don't know, I look for compassion and resiliency. somebody that can, you know, do all the things they need to do and have the things bounce off them so they can stay focused, you know, stay on target, help their teams. At the same time, having compassion for the people that are on your team, because having empathy when you're resilient is hard. So I kind of go a little bit differently in having the compassion, being able to understand what other people are going through, even if you can't necessarily put your foot in their shoes because it's bouncing off you. Beyond that, I mean, all the things that James hit on, the skills and abilities you have to have. I mean, I totally agree with that. I'd add one more. Like, if you really want to be a CISO, like, I think there's something wrong with you. I've had that role twice before, and I've like never again. Like, no, like it's I'm happy one level down from that, just because you're at the top of the totem pole. You're the guy who gets beat on all day long, 24/7, 365. You're getting beat on from both directions, from the people that are your peers that are above you, people that are underneath you. All your reports are always calling you 24/7. Having that, again, the resiliency, because you're going to get beat on 24/7, being, you know, out front. You are the figurehead for that organization. And so, again, it takes a special type of person to be able to do this and do it effectively. At the same time, support that healthy culture within their own teams and be able to align with the businesses. I mean, it's a magic combination that I don't want to have.
Anton left us. Google Mr. Emergency. Taylor, I guess Google that brings it over to you to wrap it up before we jettison people.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Spotlight. Well, those are really hard to follow. So I'm going to be, I guess, more tactical. One, I'm all about empowering the team, give them opportunities to succeed, even fail, and sort of even not protect them from failure, but don't hold them to that. Let them learn from it. So I'm very much a team-oriented kind of person. I think, you know, you get farther with more with people around you and help drive that forward. So a lot of empathy and understand their perspective and give them opportunity, give them direction and let them go. I think a lot of people get in leadership positions and feel like they have to micromanage everything around them. And they kind of like fine tune every little thing. No, give somebody point at the hill and say, go take the hill and see how well they do. And I'll bet you 9 times out of 10, they'll do well. Don't let perfection get in the way of excellence. Don't be afraid to fail. I think a lot of people are terrified, like something's going to happen. Yes, from a security perspective and hackers, of course. But I think it's as you move through and kind of explore different paths to take and different options, like I mentioned earlier, fail fast. But also, you know, keep your ears open, listen to what people have to say. You know, you were given 2 years, one mouth for a reason kind of thing. And I would say is I think more tactically what I see is like everybody wants to automate everything. And I've seen a lot of CISOs go, we're going to automate that. And I'm like, but you haven't even defined it yet. You know, so I think there's a component around just be more mindful about what you're setting in motion, because in some cases you have to live with that and explain it to the business and get your team to kind of facilitate it. So anyway, embrace your team, allow people to make mistakes, move quickly, fail fast, and just get the job done. Keep moving forward.
I love it. All right. Well, we're going to bid a fair adieu to Eric. Thanks for playing along. It's good to have you here on 600.
That's awesome. To be here.
We'll have you back later.
Thank you much. If Robert shows up, tell him I said hello.
All right. Rob's about to jump in. Arsenic's about to jump in a minute and taking your spot, obviously. Yeah, and then Mr. Beeson, thank you for jumping in and sharing your expertise once again. Always valuable and you've got a unique perspective that I hope folks that listen take to heart, because you've done this for a minute.
Yeah. 19 going on 60.
Thank you. All right, guys.
It's always great. Looking forward to hearing
them. All right. I'm going to drop you guys out here. Just give me a second here. All right. Bye-bye there. And bye-bye there. And let's see if this works. All right, here we go. I got Arsenic.
Hey,
there he is. All right. And Tom, he's in. Tom, can you hear us?
I can indeed. How you doing? All right.
And James Christiansen will be in a minute, I think, because he's kind of currently he's jumping in. All right. So it's just the six of us for a minute. You know, we spent the last hour talking about the kind of qualities and challenges of being a CISO. I'm going to flip this on the other side of it, but first I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a welcome. The two new entrants into the ring of pain, the guy that actually has a kind of killer podcast on his own right, The Snake Show.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like The Smoke Show, but and he's written a book on AI.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, you want to tell people about yourself? Because I don't think I'm doing you justice, man.
You're doing pretty good, actually. Yeah, I've been in computer security for 28 years now and ran some companies, recently sold BitDiscovery to Tenable, and now starting a fund, Grossman Ventures, with Jeremiah Grossman. And yeah, I did just write a book on AI. It's called AI's Best Friend. And I do have a podcast called The Arsenic Show.
There you go. And you did not, it did not take you 20 minutes to try to get the video working this time.
No,
so no, no. All the other plugs out.
No secret cameras this time, Raph.
I think that was like the day that the camera on the phone became an acceptable use case for like your video camera. Like Apple had turned that feature on. I might've been in a beta mode or something. And so like, it was a very strange sensation suddenly having a camera pointing at somewhere. I'm like, where is this camera?
Nice. All right. Well, I'm going to let's see what happens. I'm going to add James Christiansen. James. All right. Mr. Christiansen, if you can hear us, you can turn your video on so we can see your smiling face. Do that for me when you can hear me. Maybe we'll see. He's in the middle. There he is. So
wow, I haven't seen you, James, in years, man. It's great to see you again.
James, introduce yourself, because I'm going to struggle to do Arsenic justice. I'm definitely not going to do you justice.
Oh, thanks, guys. Sorry, you're joining me here in my bedroom. I've got kids floating all over, so I got kicked out of my office for a bit. So I'm James Christiansen. Really, really happy to be here. I've known Ralph and Jim Tiller for a long time. Probably run into the rest of you guys. I've been in security leadership for, gosh, I think almost 40 years, 35 years, something like that. Mid-80s, I was first CISO at Visa back then. Imagine Visa with no security policies, none at all. We were an engineering company. I was running parts of the network, and they asked me to do security. We had a security breach, like every good company, so we need security. So I went from there to General Motors as their worldwide global CISO, running all operations, both financial and the manufacturing companies. From there to, let's see, Experian. In San Diego or Orange County. There I was the first CISO and CSO, I guess, with Land Information Security. From there, and by the way, it's over a long period of time, so it sounds like I can't keep a job for like 3 months, but you know, it's like over 30 years. Right? So I went out and I decided to do the entrepreneur thing. I started a company called Avantix, founder and CEO, and ran that till 2012, sold it, and then went to Octave, where I met a lot of my colleagues here and ran their risk management program and the CISO success program, some of those things, and eventually third-party risk for Octave. From there to Teradata as their first CISO. Really enjoyed that back in San Diego, and joined Netskope now, about 4.5 years at Netskope, and love my life, love my job, man. I got the best job anybody could have.
I don't know. I think I a lot of us love it. All right. Last but absolutely not least, Tom, are you actually – should I have you local? Are you actually here in Atlanta now?
Yeah, I've become a U.S. taxpayer these days.
Sorry to hear that. Welcome to the pain. So tell us a little bit about you, because I know you've been a guest on before, but we'll take your name and number.
Yeah, so I'm I think my official title these days is Director of Enterprise Solutions, which means I'm trying to cross the world between GRC, cybersecurity, application security, identity, and everything else we do at Turnkey. Gives me a pretty broad portfolio, but I've been doing it 20 years, securing large-scale ERPs for Fortune 550 companies. And I always like to annoy Raph with problems he doesn't want to solve, like identity and HR.
The HR one was fun because nobody saw that coming, and I think most people still don't. It was a fascinating discussion. So if you guys want to go back and listen to that, that was a good one too. All right, as I said, we spent the last hour of this 2-hour set here talking about the qualities and sort of the challenges of the CISO role, what you got to watch out for, things you shouldn't say so you don't go to jail, those kinds of things. I want to flip this the other way now. As an industry, okay, with RSA not even 5 days away, and everybody is just, I can tell everybody in this room right here is just so thrilled that RSA is coming. We cannot contain ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that said, the goat rodeo of Vendor Palooza that is coming next week is going to be super interesting for a couple of reasons to me. One, there will probably be 9,000 new vendors I've never met yet, and I won't be able to understand what they do.
That I'll do AI.
I was going to say, Raf, you know already, it's going to, everybody does AI now, like threat analytics a couple years ago. Everybody did threat analytics. Didn't matter their identity, they did threat analytics. Now it'll be AI.
It'll be AI. But so more vendors are going to show up. Some vendors will have been subsumed into the larger beasts. Some will have simply run out of money and gone away. Economically, this is a weird time, right? The macro is sort of interesting for us. Arsenic, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to ask you this because you're probably closest. Well, you and Collins maybe are probably the closest to the both the world of investors and technology. Rob, start with you. Tell me your perspective on where we are in terms of macroeconomic conditions and as it relates to like tech innovation. And I will preface this by saying, please, somebody give me an actual solution to something, because we've all sold solutions at one point or another. We actually haven't solved crap, I don't think. So that's my jaded question.
Those are very, very different questions, my friend.
Well, then you can answer two different answers. Yeah, go.
Let me start with the first one. Well, I think coming off of the pandemic and watching what happened, let's say 2 years ago at RSA, It's like it would happen during RSA, which was really interesting. When RSA started, all of our valuations were fine. By the end of RSA, all our valuations had tanked, like maybe as much as 3x in some cases, and sometimes more. And so I've been looking at some of the biggest players out there and kind of looking at their balance sheets, and they went on an acquisition spree. They just bought it all up because it's not like the ideas were necessarily bad, but they know that they're just nowhere near worth what they should be, what they thought their investors could get for it. And I think there's two things going on there. One, no one is worth anywhere near what they think they are, like not even close. And I mean this literally across the board, and there's lots of reasons I think this. It's not that their valuations aren't high. It's that those valuations have absolutely no bearing at all on what their company is actually worth once you take in all the hidden liabilities. So a hidden liability would be, for example, in our space, well, you're going to get hacked tomorrow and you're not going to be worth anything because everyone needs you to be a very, very secure company and you're not. But it's like an unrealized loss. You just haven't, the bad thing hasn't happened yet. I was talking with a pretty big insurance broker. They're one of the biggest. They're more on the SMB side though. And they have about 40% loss associated with their print, with whatever the premium volume is. So if they pull in $1 billion, $400 million is paid out in premiums or paid out in payments associated with breaches. And that account that turns into about 70,000, approximately 60,000 to 70,000 per claim. And on the high end, it's something like $400,000 per claim. And this is for SMBs. So you can imagine what it's like for the enterprise, right? These are multi-million dollar, sometimes way more than that type of claims. And once you start adding up all of the places where that can happen, there's a lot of unrealized loss. But then there's other types of things like the macroeconomics that you're talking about that cause these massive degradation in valuations that are, I think really most companies are worth as little as 1/10 of what they think that they're worth. Still, like even with that correction we saw a couple of years ago. Now, fast forwarding, what I think is going to end up happening is there's still going to be a lot of dumb money in InfoSec. According to the McKinsey report that came out a handful of months back, they believe that we're going to see the industry grow from the whatever 170 billion or so, I guess, in the industry, something like the 167, I think, is what they're currently saying the cybersecurity industry is, to around 2 trillion in total value extracted from the market over the next 10 years, which means even dumb money is going to make very, very good gains. But if you're smart money, you should be able to do well. So I still think there's plenty of money to be made in InfoSec, even stupid investments, which is why you see so much dumb capital being put into the players at RSA.
So, okay. And to add to that, and this is kind of where things go sideways for me, is what I'm struggling with is, yes, there's a lot of dumb money and there's a lot of people making just like random bets, and even bad bets are paying a little. So this is like one of those situations. It feels like one of those situations where investors like, I can't lose. Like, I can't make a bad bet. Everything's going to be great. But we saw the correction, right? And suddenly the cost of borrowing and valuations went in opposite directions. Why didn't we see it wipe out more of the market? Because good Lord, I wish it had.
Well, I think there was some correction there.
You're muted. Sorry, that was my fault.
Yeah. Why are you muting me, dude? I'm like right here. Sorry. I'm paying attention. I'm not like doing stuff in the background. Let's say I think that there would be some correction going on there. And I did see a handful of companies that I know very well that we predicted about 4 or 5 years earlier would go to zero. And mostly you can tell when that's going to happen because their valuations have absolutely nothing to do with their earnings. And they're pricing themselves so high that there's just not many buyers out there. And that's when you know that they're dead walking. You know, they're just waiting for some one or two bad quarters. They're going to see a massive reshuffling of the executive team. They're not going to make it work, and then it's going to be a fire sale. And so we did see some of that happen, and some go to absolute zero. So I think what you're really seeing, Raph, is just there's just that much dumb money in InfoSec.
All right. Well, Cause, I'm going to come back to you, because I should just name a podcast called the James Show. Have James Christiansen, James Beeson, James Jardine, and myself on. And then Jim, you can just become James for a day, and it'll be awesome. But Mr. Christiansen, I'm going to ask you this: what's your take on this? Because you've started a couple company or two. You've watched this on arguably. And this is not to call you old, but you just had a longer horizon than a couple of us here. Any different takes on this?
You know, you can call me old because it fits, man. I am old. It's so fun to watch the cycles, you know, and to see as we progress through these different changes. I mean, timing is everything in a company. I mean, you know, right now, if you were going to raise, I love this thought of dumb money because I remember back, you know, in the dot-com days, or if you could write something on a napkin, somebody to hand you, you know, $10 million to go. And then, you know, during the financial crisis, you couldn't raise a nickel for anything. So I did an equity raise, you know, before that. And then I had to raise money during the entire financial crisis. Talk about hard. It was really hard. And then after, you know, I did the raise for CyberGRX. And that wasn't really too bad, but it was in that they were really more diligent than they had been. I think I still see that, you know, if I'm talking to folks, they're looking more, you know, you didn't even have to have positive revenue back in those early days. Now you've got to at least have a product. You've got to have really some backbone behind it. They look really strong at the management team, or it's just a management team that, you know, they like to bet on the jockeys, you know, and the horse will make it. So I think, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how the election changes things. You know, we're like 5 months out. And what's that going to do to our economy? And people are in hold mode already. I'm seeing a lot of people say, well, let's wait and see. Yeah, it's more on the microeconomic side, but you know, I loved your comments. Those are great. I'm here to learn too.
Hey, I want to pitch this to Tom because Tom typed in the window here a great question, and I want to let you ask it. Maybe somebody wants to answer, or maybe you want to take a swing at it, Tom.
I'm not sure I can answer it, but I wonder to what extent that dumb money is following headlines. You know, we see fear mongering all over the place, and there was a headline the other day: cybercrime could cost the world $10.5 trillion by the end of next year. You know, in the face of headlines like that, investing $2.5 trillion over the next few years seems like a safe bet for investors. But I'm curious to hear what everybody else thinks.
Well, somebody's got to buy something, right? So, I mean, that's a huge that's a huge number, right? So, who's going to be spending that much more in security, right? So are we flooding the market with investments and capability? Are we certain that there's going to be a consumption? Is there a market there for it?
I think there is, and it's mostly on the MSSP and services market. I think what's happened is we've seen a massive, and you guys can feel free to absolutely disagree with this, but this is anecdotes I've gotten from many, many different people. So I'd be happy to hear that I'm wrong. But when I talk to people, I'm seeing that they feel that the market is now flooded with people who don't know what they're doing. And so we have a lot of them. We just don't have people who really understand what they need to do for their job function, whatever that is within InfoSec. And the problem with that is you cannot hire your way out of that problem. You cannot backfill even more people to fix the problem of the people not being good. Like it's you know, some measure of just them not caring. Some of it is they didn't get trained properly. Some of it is the information is harder to get than it used to get it. Or, you know, maybe they're just not as passionate about it. Maybe it's a 9-to-5. There's a million reasons that could be happening, but the end result would be we have to have a centralization. We have to have a couple of choke points where there's a really good talent, like really know what they're doing. They can manage security for thousands or tens of thousands of organizations because you can't hire them, especially if you're the SMBs, the little guys. This is what Wendy Nather always talks about, the security below the poverty line. Like they have to have security too. And so they're not going to be able to hire, you know, anybody on this call for sure. And so how do you give them security with a budget? And the only way to do that is with MSSPs or managed security providers that offer software as a service or whatever.
Okay. That makes total sense to me because I was like, man, who?
Sorry. Mute.
Raph muted you, Tim.
Why?
I didn't do that one.
He hates me too. He hates me. He hit the hate
button. He found out he could do it.
Somebody take the controls away from Raph.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. So let me repeat that. Let me say it again. It's that that makes total sense to me. At first I was thinking, oh man, another wave of products kind of thing, but I get the MSSP piece. I think there's a lot of organizations out there that are struggling to get access to enterprise class type of security and they need it just as much as anybody else. I think that's actually an incredibly fair statement. So that actually makes total sense. I think where I'm very curious to see how this is all going to pan out because there's so much pressure now with regards to reporting and there's a new wave of regulation and governance putting pressure on organizations to sort of report and stuff like that. I'm kind of wondering how that's going to affect sort of this sort of midterm activity, right? So we're still getting this huge growth, but I still think we're still evolving. The dynamic is changing pretty rapidly. And I'm with you, James. I think, goodness gracious, the next, you know, 5 months and the shortly thereafter is going to be some really interesting things. So there's a lot of dynamics to play. I'm not really sure. Honestly, I don't disagree, Snake, that MSSP, that's really smart. I totally get that. I did not take it from that perspective at all. But wow, is it going to get interesting over the next
According to McKinsey, they should comprise, the MSSPs and software as a service models should comprise about 50% of the total market gain.
Holy mother.
That's amazing.
Hey,
let's go start an MSSP guy.
Yeah, James. I'm with him. Let's go.
Jeff, I'm going to pitch this over to you because I think collectively you and I worked at one and you've built a couple. So you've got some MSP, plus you have like 15 startups you're in. talk to me about this because I think you're in a unique position in the builder side of actually in that race.
Well, so one thing I would add, and you know, I always hear this, you know, why does money still flow? when you have macroeconomic conditions that look this way, you know, we've got interest rates where capital isn't cheap. Money certainly is still flowing, because we have to look at it as investors are like socialists. There's really no difference. And here's why. I'm going to explain this for you, Mr. Rafal.
So, yes, please.
So when we think about it, so within socialism, socialism works as long as there's, you know, someone else's money. Well, investing in security companies works as long as there's someone else's money. It's exactly the same paradigm. And we see this at RSA every year. You know, we're going to all walk around and we're going to see 3,000 different companies who will not be there next year. Yet all the people in the 3,000 companies will magically be there next year. Every one of those people will still come back. And they come back every year with a new badge and a new shirt, and they have a new Nike polo every single year. And the reality is that that's because, you know, let's assume that somebody gets, you know, pre-seed money through a safe, and then they get their first price round, and then they get their second price round, and they go down this path. Well, the reality is that while they're going through all those pricing rounds and some early stage company or early stage investment shop is investing in them, there's always a private equity firm that's coming along and just waiting for that to go scoop that up and hopefully get 1,000 of these security companies and have 2 of them work. And that's why all this works. And so that's why we have investments. And then people like Arsenate go out and write a book on AI. And so then there's like 2,000 other security companies that read his book. And then they create their security widget off of Arsenate's book. And so at the end of all of this, the true fault is Arsenate.
He's going to get the $2 trillion.
Yeah, right?
That's true.
Yeah, I tend to agree that it's my fault, but for totally different reasons. So if you start a company and you have the intention of making it go in this industry, you're generally trying to get huge multiples, and that's part of where a lot of this craziness is coming from. It's not, you know, once upon a time when we started security, it was mostly a lifestyle business. A couple of us had some idea that maybe we can get acquired someday, but you know, that has dramatically changed. The business of InfoSec has turned into real true business. And what that means is, if you're dumb money and you're looking at the industry and you're following the news, which is not a very good way to see what's going on, you will see crazy headlines. And if you're a spreadsheet investor, you're going to go, yeah, I can get the same kind of multiples that I could get anywhere in any industry, except for this market itself is going. So I'm just going to put my money in these things. As you said, there's probably a safe note, and I probably already have contacts with all these PEs, and they're all spreadsheet investors for the most part. And we sort of have a backroom agreement. They will take my shitty investment off my hands as long as I can package it up good enough. And they like me because I'm giving them a lot of deals, and the deal flow kind of goes back and forth. And this is kind of weird, kind of shady backroom agreements. And even if I'm like, if the time horizon's like enormous, like let's say it's like 20 years, well, my VC is only gonna last like 7 to 10, let's say. Well, I got to get the hell out of it, right? My investors require me to get out of it. I can't run the VC forever. So there's a whole like liquidity, like back end liquidity groups that will just kind of like come in, sweep up, and they'll just grab all these assets. And they're not really dead. They're still functioning, but they'll get them for like 60 cents on the dollar. And then they'll find some mega company to go pick them up, like a Cisco or whatever. And so you see all these acquisitions happening, and really what it's coming down to is there's a couple of pieces of intellectual property. Maybe they're grabbing somebody for a golden handcuff. And frankly, no one gives a shit. And that's why, Raph, when you started this conversation, no one gives a shit because it doesn't matter if you're actually solving security problems. It actually doesn't matter. Like, no one cares about that. Yeah. And
that is the heart of the problem I have with this entire Goat Rodeo right now. I keep calling it that. But that is the entire problem I have with it, is that nobody seems to actually care about solving security problems.
Well, no one's even
We're measuring. Just all in it to make some cash.
No one's even measuring the problem. And I think that's the sort of biggest issue here, So if I have a good product and this and the competitor has a bad product, how do I market it in a way that they can't market it? I mean, they're both allowed to say they're the best in the market. They're the number one, you know,
market leading.
Class, market leading, right? There's no way to guarantee it, which is one of the reasons why Jeremiah and I have really liked the idea of cyber warranties, because at minimum now the insurance providers have to agree that they will not lose money on your product. So if product A is good and they're like, okay, we can insure this one or, you know, put a warranty behind it, and product B is bad and we can't because the statistics prove that it doesn't work, you will never see product B with a warranty. And so if we can just sort of force the industry and force buyers to get more educated on why this matters and ask, just even ask the question, do you have a warranty? And if not, why not? And even if they can't or don't get it, it'll start an interesting conversation.
All right, Tom, you've been awfully quiet over there. I'm sure you've got something to add to this because we were typing back and forth, but let's hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll snake it in. Nobody cares. We've been having this conversation for a long time, and on paper, it is dumb. It is a good investment because everybody wants to solve the security problem. Everybody agrees that we should do something about this. You know, these rises in threats, these rises in everything else. But once you get to where the rubber meets the road and you've got to stand in that boardroom and justify several million dollars of investment in a security solution, then that's where it gets tricky. All of a sudden, we've got to start, and tying it back to what you were talking about before the break, we have to be able to speak the business language just to get the investment to do the bare minimum of security, not just everything we'd like to do, but just to keep the lights on and tick over and keep the businesses operating. So I think that's the piece that the investors miss is once this hits CFO approval or board level approval, it's a much more difficult conversation than it is on paper. So that spreadsheet accounting just isn't realistic.
We can certainly talk about that. I think one quick point though. So I ran into a former CISO who became a vendor, and he was kind of talking, he was sort of lamenting the fact that like moving from the buy side to the sell side and like what that process was like for him personally. And he said one of the conversations he kept having over and over was with his other CISO buddies. And they're all so like, why are you leaving to become a vendor? Why are you doing this? You know, you're going to be on the bad side or whatever. And he thought what they meant was bad side, like they're the bad act, the vendor's the bad actor and the CISOs are the good guys. What they actually meant was the opposite. It's like, we have a good thing going with having all these vulnerabilities out there. Why are you closing down our money train? And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, and yeah. Like this massively, it kind of uncovered this massive kind of unspoken, unethical incentives that are built up in the way CISOs operate currently. So when I say I don't think anyone cares, I really do mean I don't think anyone cares. I don't think the CISOs care. I don't think the vendors care. I don't think the investors care. I just don't think that there's will to fix this problem.
Well, I'll take it one step further.
Don't kill the golden goose.
Go ahead.
Just one point to that is if you extrapolate, you would say is that look how big the economy is. What would we just say it's going to grow to 2 trillion. Sorry.
2 trillion.
So if we fix the problem, what are we going to do with, a 2 trillion market, right?
I think I'm going to challenge a little bit on that, Rob. I don't know a CISO that wants a vulnerability. There's not a CISO on earth that wants to be subject to a breach. I mean, it's a hard job, man. When you're under that kind of pressure, nobody wants that. I mean, I would love to be able to just do podcasts all afternoon and not have to do this operational stuff. So I'm going to challenge a little bit on that. I don't know. And I heard what you said. I'm going, what CISO are you talking about that really wants us to
I will get him on this podcast to tell you the exact same thing he told me. But I'm not making this story up. And
somebody said it. I'd just love to understand what kind of motivation they have.
Rob, you're on the hook. Let's get them on.
I will be happy to do that.
But James, let me kind of push this a little bit further with you, because you've been in that CISO chair long enough to have seen several of these go rounds and evolutions, right? Because this really is somewhere between a 7 and 10 year cycle. Like we go through identity is important, then we switch to something else, and we switch to something else, and now we're back to identity. And when now it's zero trust. We used to call that micro segmentation. When it was before that, it was just segment your network, like good hygiene kind of stuff. are we inventing anything, or are we just inventing new packaging things? And I ask that explicitly, and here's why. Because I think of a very specific company that was a technology that was out for a while. Okay, and we'll see if you guys can guess who I'm thinking of. A technology that was out for a while. It wasn't particularly sexy, but they spent a tremendous amount of money on it, hired somebody that had some government, we'll say glad-handing capabilities and knew some people. And suddenly they are on every news channel. They're ubiquitous for, you know, the IR space, and they are all over the place. And so but every practitioner I ever talked to said their technology was hot garbage, but they were told to use it because some insurance person said that's what we back. So who wants to take that? Because this is very, to me, this is very visceral. It's very real.
You know, I lost your question in there, Raph. What was your question? It kind of went on for a while.
Yeah, no. I tend to ramble if nobody stops me. But what I'm asking for is, are we really creating? Is there the new companies that come up? Do you think that there's actually new solutions out there, or are we just repackaging the same old shit?
You know, in IT, you know, it's great. I think we make up new acronyms so we can make more money. I mean, it was VM before. It was, you know, we had virtualization of mainframes, and we went to client server, and every iteration is just taking what we did before. We put a new name on it, and now it's something different. I think your example, micro-segmentation, zero trust. I'm not really a fan of the term zero trust. Being an executive a long time, when you go in to your executive team and you say, "Hey, we've got a new project. It's called zero trust," you'll get a reaction that says, "Oh, you're the security guy. You don't trust anybody." And that's not what you want, right? You want more of a positive reaction. So. And that, and, you know, zero trust for folks who've been around a while, they think of ZTNA. So, zero trust, that's ZTNA. I bought some RSA tokens, I'm good. And that's not zero trust either. And so I don't really like the term. So I like the term of continuous adaptive trust and thinking about, now that is different than what we've done before, because what adaptive trust really is about is being able to take all kinds of different telemetry that we didn't have available. We can look at the location, we can look at the device, we can look at the person, we can look at the content, and we can look at all this in real time and make stronger, that's not very good English, right? My grandma would roll over. We can make better decisions about risk in real time. I'll give you a quick example. You know, in the old days, if I had, let's say I've got an attorney, they're working on a project like minutes for the board meeting, and they're at home and they're working from their Office PC, the one we granted them, and they're storing it in OneDrive. That's the right place. It's secure. Everything's good. So I can look at all that telemetry. Now I can say, yeah, that's all good because I've got strong authentication. I've looked at, you know, all their access. I've got access to all that telemetry. Where in the old days, I was just seeing they're trying to access this, and it's them, and can they do it or not? Well, now let's just take that scenario the next step. Let's say they go out to coffee. They got their iPad with them. They go, I forgot to update that one thing. So now they're out, you know, maybe to Starbucks. They've got their iPad. They log in. They've got strong authentication. Great. They want to update that. Well, I would have to normally say, no, you're on an untrusted device from an untrusted location. No, we can't do that. But now with continuous adaptive trust, I can say, wait a minute. I can actually change the situation. I can say, you can update it, but you can only update it in place. I'm just not going to let you download it to that untrusted device. So now I can say, yes. Where I'd have had to before. So that's kind of the benefits of being able to get to continuous adaptive trust and be able to make those real-time decisions. And I think that is something new. That's something we couldn't have done, you know, 5-10 years ago.
I would fully expect a call from Gartner any minute now, Mr. Christiansen. They're going to ask for a white paper, and they're going to ask for the rights to the Magic Quadrant.
Right, there we go.
But I think that's a really good way of pivoting the conversation towards a solution to a business problem. Yeah. Because the more that we're seen as enabling the business and not the people that say no, but saying yes, but the more effective we are at the change that we need to see. So if we can enable them to work the way they want to work and make security part of that business partner enablement piece, I think we get there. So I'm going to back you on that one, James. Let me know when you're talking to Gartner.
There we go. There we go. Well, I think we got $2 trillion. We can find some investment money. Yeah.
I think if we're going to be talking about the language of business, I think the largest problem our industry has is that we talk in terms that you would find in elementary school. We say ABC, we say red, yellow, green. We talk about high, medium, and low. Like, these are not the languages of business. The business is, you know, the British pound or the US dollar. And while we're still focused on, you know, I have this SQL injection vulnerability and I want to change our grade from a B minus to a B plus or whatever, so I need $50,000. Like, that, like, no one's going to take us seriously. We're never really ever going to be talking the same language as the CFO, who's the real risk officer of the company. And for the CFO to take us seriously, they need to hear words like, I can reduce the total cost or the liabilities of this company by $2 million if you give me $50,000. That's a money in, money out type operation. Now, they might say, well, where's your math? Okay, well, if you have the math, like, here's the likelihood of breach, here's the cost of remediation post-compromise, here's the damage potential if it blasts, and, you know, here's all the things it would be subject to, and, you know, downstream effects and so on. Something lighter than fair, but along the lines of fair. At least now you're having the conversation that the rest of all of the entirety of the rest of business is having. And until we have that conversation, until we're talking like that, I think we're always going to be at the kids' table.
Yeah, you know, I got to disagree with you there a lot. You're so right on. I mean, when we talk about, hey, I need to do this because I need to install Zero Trust. Well, they don't see a value on Zero Trust. So why are they going to take funds? Because they're going to make decisions, right? I've got this big pot of money, and I'm going to dole it out. And you're talking about Zero Trust. This guy over here is talking about opening a new bank, you know, and I can see the revenue stream from that. What I found more successful, and I did it once, you know, experiments worked great. I walked into my budget meeting and I said, I opened up and I was with the CEO and the CFO. And I said, hey, before we get started, I did some math. I drove $800 million in revenue last year.
There you go.
And they popped and, you know, like looked up from their books and go, what are you talking about? I said, well, what I did was I went and looked at all the customers that I had to meet with and convince them we had a good security program, or they would have either dropped us or not come with us. So I know I took credit for the wholesale, but that's how I came up with the number. It made sense to them. They could see how we were adding value on the revenue side, right? And if you're talking to the CFO, you're going to talk about how you're reducing costs. You know, they're bottom line folks. So I think it's really important, you know, not only speak in terms they understand, but also understand where the audience is. Like, the CEO wants to know how you're driving revenue. So talk about how you're finding and retaining profitable customers, how you're helping drive. If you're talking to the CFO, he wants to hear about how he's going to be more profitable. So how are you going to consolidate solutions next year, reduce your overall operational costs? You know, don't talk to him about, you know, you're going to install DLP. You know, that's not a subject they're going to want to hear about. CIO, what do they want to hear? Faster resolution of problems, you know, better transparency, better visibility, you know, to problem solving. So I think it's just a lesson that Rob, I think you said it very well. You got to speak the language that they understand, not acronym soup.
Yeah. Interesting.
I literally had this exact conversation the other day chatting to a CISO, well, an IT manager under the CISO, and they had a 20-day lag on provisioning access across all their applications. 65K employees, you know, a little bit of back of the cigarette packet maths. And I'm like, well, that's as much as 8.25 million, you know, lowballing some of the numbers that you're losing in lost productivity. And you can't find the investment for something to help you fix that. Let's go talk to your CFO and say, I can save you 8.25 million, not I need 800K to invest in this.
Right.
Once you change the narrative, you can actually get something done.
But I think, you know, Tom, to that point, I think the real problem here is, and we talked about this in the last hour, was, you know, when you think about a strategic CISO or a tactical CISO, tactical CISOs do exactly what you're talking about. You know, they talk about that the problem is that, you know, it takes too long to get a get someone on board or things like that. Strategic CISOs walk in and they talk about, you know, how that's directly affecting either the top or the bottom line. You know, I love James's response. You know, I drove, you know, this massive amount of revenue. And the reality is that, you know, in that regard, James was probably one of the best salespeople that that company had. Because, you know, that $800 million went away. But from a C-suite level and from a board level, they just saw James as a CISO that tells everybody no and, you know, probably talks in three-letter acronyms every single day. But the reality is that when you change that dynamic and you change that conversation, it changes it for everybody. And I think from the CISO perspective, CISOs need to do more and more of that every day. They need to think about those things. They need to become strategic. They need to have those conversations. And oftentimes that's going to take them jumping out of their comfort zone. You know, maybe that CISO is very much a tactical CISO, and maybe they're, you know, very rudimentary from a strategic perspective. But oftentimes in a C-suite in an organization, you have a lot of people who are strategic. And, you know, you can certainly learn from them and you can certainly see how they operate and see how they run. I mean, the easiest way to do it is go find your CRO. Your CRO talks about all the great things they do every day. The reality is they probably only do those on one day a week and then 6 days they golf. But on that one day, they look amazing. And so go follow them around. Understand what they do. Understand how they portray their story, because they're taking a story where, you know, the quota for the year is $800 million and they hit 12 and they're magically above their number. And they do that every single year in every one of these organizations. And so go learn from them, change that conversation a little bit. Now, we don't need to lie or change things in that regard. I'm certainly not advocating that, but certainly get a little more strategic in the way that you tell that story. And to your point, Tom, I think that's a great example of how, you know, you can change that story, change that dynamic, and get dollars in your pocket to go and invest in the things that it takes to make the business run.
Interesting. All right, so
we lost the original question, Raph, which is the proliferation of vendors.
we did, and let me go back to that, because we're talking about getting budget and having and being able to justify it and all that. But I think that the complete other side of that teeter totter is a mass of vendors that are, say, like mentioned before, like we can't. Even those of us on the vendor side who know these vendors, if you strip the logo and the colors off, we can't tell them apart that way anyway, right?
Something like 160 different OSN companies right now. 160. But why? I mean, I could see maybe five or something. You know, maybe they do slightly different things, but that just gives you some sense of what we're up against.
How many problems are they solving?
That's a good question.
Maybe a lot.
I don't know.
How many problems do they create?
I'm going to ask that from that perspective. How many problems? Problems. I can say it. How many problems do all the vendors create for CISOs for one of a couple of reasons? One, they're all best of breed. None of them work with each other. Two, they seem to all be great at some things and catastrophically bad at others. And nobody, I haven't found a significant number of them across all the product categories that are like 80% and not in on the good and not like also 80% in the bad, right? And then back to you again, Rob, about the whole like warranty thing. You know, how many of these vendors do we accept with the shrink wrap that's, you know, you're buying the software to protect you and it says like, hey, by installing this, you accept all liability. This is all on you. Sucks to be you. Thanks for the check. Where do we go with that? Because that is a problem I'd like all everything else being equal. I would like to solve that bit.
I don't have a great solution for you, but what I will say is the more we get the vendors who are doing it correctly need to get a lot better at communicating why they're better. And I don't mean because my widget does one thing slightly better than your widget. I don't mean that. I mean, if you can't back it up, if you can't put your money where your mouth is and eat your own dog food and actually put your own money on the line, then you probably don't know if your product even works. And if you don't know if it works, then why should anyone take a chance on it? Like, it doesn't make sense. So I think if we start talking as a community about, like, this is something we just need to, like, broad scale talk about, like, why aren't you willing to bet your own money that your product works? Like, why? Just give me the answer. Like, is it just because it's so new? Am I taking a risk because it's brand new? Okay, well, maybe I'm willing to take that risk. If you've got 500 customers and you still can't prove it, that's a problem. That's like a really, really big problem. We did some analysis on the vulnerability management space a while back, and talking with the cyber insurers who have to actually pay out these things. And they're like, yeah, you know, whatever. There's like something like 20,000 CVEs or something. I don't forget the real number, whatever it is.
An absurdly large amount.
Many tens of thousands anyway. And they said, yeah, there's about 64 exploits that actually lead to loss. And so it's like, well, what are we doing with the rest of the 20,000 things that these vulnerability scanners are checking for? Are they just wasting everybody's time? Because if that's the case, like, what are we doing? You know, like, what exactly is our industry providing as a service? Just a huge drain on companies while they figure out what to fix and not to fix? Because it's not obvious by looking at it. It says high, but it's not a high, or it says it's a low, but it's a high, you know, or whatever those words even mean. And by the way, for anyone listening who thinks that actually makes sense, if I have five mediums, how many highs is that worth? How do you do that math?
Exchange.
If you can't do the math, then it's not math. Then it's just guesswork. And I'd like to get away from that.
Well, so Jeremiah, this is the question I've repeated to people several times, because Jeremiah did this to me once in a conversation, and he said, you know, if I've got 10 SQL injection vulnerabilities and I solve 9 of them, how much have I done? How much work have I done? How much security risk have I reduced? And it turns out that is that's kind of that's not an easy. I don't think that's an easy question to solve. And there are so many variables to this, there are so many other things that we need to worry about that it's an incomplete math problem. There's too many unknowns. And then we go back to where I think we live on a daily basis, and that's guesswork.
Now, Raph, you said there was 10 and they took out 9 of them. Well, you reduce your risk by 90%. Isn't that obvious?
I mean, but there's no one even really working on this problem, to be honest. I mean, everyone's coming up with these weird scores. And when I talk to the best and brightest to work on these problems and like actually try to come up with this math, I'm like, show me your math. So they show me their math. And I'm like, there's this one part of your math where you're multiplying it by 1.3. Why 1.3? And they're like looking at me and I'm looking at them like, well, we could change it. I'm like, what? Like, you know, like, well, if you want to make it bigger, I'm like, no. I'm not saying I want to change this. I'm saying, where the fuck did you get it? I'm like, well, it looks better.
And that's the thing though, right? I mean, that like all this, especially posture management, you're seeing that come out. Like everything is rating your systems, ranking it, you know, like, oh, I've got a score of this, but it like, where's the math? But nobody questions that math. They just like the pretty numbers. You know, they like the fact that they see it. So we go from CVEs, we go to KVE, we go to like all these dang different systems and nothing ever.
There was some research paper that came out a handful of years back that basically said that CVE was worse than flipping a coin in terms of reliability. Worse, not the same, literally worse.
I think that came from the Kenna folks.
Maybe.
If I recall correctly.
Right. That sounds right. But that's what we're up against. We're up against people who are the best in our industry are giving us worse odds than if I just took a guess. Like that's not good. Like that we have failed miserably as an industry. It's shocking how bad we are.
To go back to that original question of what is the downside of all these vendors of 150 that do this one thing, is it not the distraction that it's causing within your organization? I mean, how many times do you have somebody come back from a conference and they're like, all right, I want you to meet with this vendor, this vendor, this vendor. They all do the same thing, but I want you to check them out, but we don't have budget for it this year, but let's go meet with them. Like the distraction and time spent looking at all these different vendors when you don't need any of them, you know, and we don't spend that time to do the analysis of what's my use case. If I was going to go to them, what am I gaining based on what I'm currently doing now? Right. We just look at it and say, oh, you have flashing lights. This looks pretty cool. Let's grab it.
But to me, this like because they're. We tried this. This was tried. The objective reviews of security tools by a neutral third party that would pit them against each other and give you objective answers on which one does it better than the others. And it turns out that that didn't work for a number of reasons. One, people were gaming the system. Two, you could pay to win. Three, there was like back to your point. I was like, on the buyer side. Nobody cared, or at least not enough people cared to make that a viable business. And then poof, it's gone.
Oh, they changed the X and Y axis.
Yeah. I mean,
well, because you know, the numbers look too far askew. So the 1.3 became a 1.75 and now it looks better.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't blame anyone for wanting to play the let's do the vendor analysis game on their own, because who else were you going to trust? I mean, you got to look at it yourself, because everyone's so unreliable and there's so many bad incentives amongst the journalists of our industry or the Gartners of the world or whatever, the Foresters and IDCs and so on. But, you know, to some extent, I feel a little bad about throwing all of these smaller vendors under the bus, because A, some of them are quite good. B, the innovation is never going to come from within these big companies. It's just not. They have the innovator's dilemma. They need to put budget behind stuff that already has revenue associated with it. They cannot waste time doing a bunch of R&D, even though they should. They cannot make it work. They cannot spend the time necessary. So generally speaking, you're never going to have innovation. And obviously it does happen, but it's very rare by comparison just to doing the land grab. By the existing headcount, the resources, the technology, the customers that already exist in the small company, buy it for dirt cheap. They pump up their revenue very slightly and they move on. That's really beneficial to our industry, because if it didn't come from these small guys, it wouldn't happen at all. But I don't think that makes up for the, as you said, the distraction and the mass of very bad security marketing that's out there.
Can I because we've got a couple minutes and we'll be up on 2 hours, and because James Christiansen said it at the beginning, and I get to bring this back to him now. So clearly everything at RSA this year is going to be about AI, because that's where the dumb money is going right now. Like, you put AI on a sticker, on an empty Amazon box, and some VC will give you $1 million for it because it has AI on it. James Christiansen, I want your opinion on this. You're a longtime CISO. You're an innovator. You're somebody that actually understands what bullshit looks like and what reality, good stuff that works, looks like. What's your take on like the current hype loop of AI?
Oh my God, Rat. I don't even know. I can address that one. It's actually the biggest I've ever seen. Now, truly, I believe Gen AI is changing the way the world's going to work. I mean, I truly believe it's going to have more impact on the way we do things than perhaps even the internet. I mean, it has a huge long-term tail. But when it comes to security, oh my goodness, I am just going to just probably hurt myself laughing when I go down on the expo floor this year, because I just know, you know, yeah, there's some real problems we need to solve. I feel for the person who has to sort all this out and figure out which one really does solve my Gen AI problem.
I think we need AI to solve the which vendor is worthwhile.
Who hasn't gone into chat and asked him what they thinks about Skynet? You know, is Skynet coming? It's a great answer. Go ahead and ask chat. They'll tell you. No, Raph, it's just there's a lot of hype. And there's a lot of good and a lot of bad that's coming on. And I think we focus on the good, kind of like every new kind of threat vector we had, we're going to have to get some good, strong governance in place and some policies, and not treat this like it's, oh my God, which I've seen a lot of folks doing. We just got to come back to security principles and take those principles and march them forward. Is that going to help you on the expo floor at RSA? Absolutely not. Because you're going to have a bullshit detector bigger than this room to figure out which one actually does something to help you solve a Gen AI problem, and which one is maybe got a Chat GPT behind them or something. I don't know. I probably didn't provide a very good answer because it's just a crazy, crazy time.
All right, we're gonna wrap. We got a couple of minutes. I'm gonna wrap this up. But the way I'm gonna wrap this up is I'm gonna go, James, I'm going to give you the final word. I'm going to give you 60 seconds. We're now 600 episodes in. All right.
Congratulations, by the way.
But thank you. At some point, we're going to come back to this. And I want you guys to give me the words of wisdom that people can take away from, that they can look back on this in 10 years and go, oh, that was some sage advice. By the way, absolutely. You need to pitch your stage presence at RSA, James.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks. Come see me. I'm going to be at RSA. I'm on the main stage on Monday, 1 o'clock. Going to talk about Gen AI governance. So it's going to be fun. Jim Roth with me, ex-CISO, amazing guy. We're going to do a great talk on that. But do you want me to go ahead and
give me your prognostication, your magic eight ball, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah. The Gen AI, I'm not going to talk about it. I'd really rather talk – kind of last seconds about being successful as a CISO.
Okay.
And I'm running into a lot of folks saying, I can't get my budget approved. And really fundamentally, if you want to take some words of wisdom, don't think about your budget as a project you're doing in October. Think about what you're going to need in a 3-year rolling plan. Start talking to the executive team the year before you need the money of what the value is. Back to your term, Snake, the business language. Be talking the whole year about the benefits, the value, the things you're going to need to continue to obtain and retain profitable customers. And it's really the social economics part, social side of, manipulating their brains to say, yeah, this has got value. Not walking in with great numbers that have ROIs and GRRs that don't make sense for risk anyway. Think about how it's benefiting the company, how it's benefiting your customers, how are you contributing to it, and make that a constant message all year long. Start the day after thinking about the next year. Start talking about it. Start showing them the value. Be consistent in your message and speak to them in business terms.
All right. Arsenic, I'm going to give it to you next. Drop some wisdom, buddy.
Well, speaking along the same lines, because I think that was really good advice. One of the things I've been told by people who work in very large PE firms, when they analyze who good CISOs are and who bad CISOs are as a measure of how well the companies have performed from a security perspective, the answer seems to be the non-technical win. And it's mostly because they are better at speaking to the board as peers than the technical CISOs tend to be. And so I would say if your goal is to be a good CISO, if you are a technical CISO, you do need to start brushing up on your communication skills, specifically bridging the gap between the different departments. And if you're already a non-technical CISO, I would lean into that skill and focus on it and not worry so much about the technology, because I think that will dictate your success.
Okay. I like that. Tom?
I completely agree with Rob there. Empathy is essential. You have to be able to speak the language of your audience, and you have to be able to secure their buy-in to get what you want, which is ultimately the investment to fix these problems. So if you're not able to do that, then surround yourself with people who are. If you are a technical CISO, bring somebody in who has those skills and can help you build that business case or make that case that you need to do. And contextualize it in terms of the risks to your business. Like, if you're in manufacturing, what stops our production line? If you're in logistics, what stops shipments going out? That is the language that your CFO is going to understand, and that's going to secure the investment.
All right. Mr. Taylor, up to you to say something controversial. It's not I agree with everybody.
Yeah. I thought I got to say something last time. I think I would just – I can't do anything better than what James, Snake, and Tom have said. And I'll just attempt to add to it by saying is – focus on those relationships. You have to build business and business relationships that have, you know, they're tangible, they're genuine, because ultimately at the end of the day, you can't, there's very little you can actually change in the business. You have to have partners across the entire environment to sort of motivate change, to reduce risk and ensure compliance and ensure security and all those kind of things. So building those relationships and communicating effectively, having empathy, all the things that we've been talking about, frankly, for the last couple hours, it really kind of hones in on you have to build good relationships. And it's coming from somebody who has learned tough lessons in that space, right? So it really is about creating relationships. It really is.
All right. Well, thanks thanks to my guests here, James Christiansen, Rob Hansen, the one and only Arsenic, not that Rob Hansen, Tom Venables, Mr. Jim Tiller, Anton Chvak, and Jeff Collins for being on earlier, James Beeson, obviously, for hanging out. Boy, it has been – oh, of course, Eric. I forgot Eric. Sorry, Eric. It has been a blast. It has been a privilege to be able to have you guys on. And I am going to now – I'm going to release you guys one by one here out of this. And then – and so thanks to the guests. We'll see you guys later. James, I'm going to hang out with you for a minute here once we – dropped everybody else because there we go, and then there we go. All right. So man, I can't believe we just recorded 600.
I'll tell you, man, it was crazy even before we even started it, coming in thinking 600. You know, when we look back at the actual time that covers, you know, yeah, we recorded 599 the other day, and you know, it's just amazing to think like when that was. I mean, what was that? It was just crazy how much time. Crazy. You know, what's really interesting is the both sets of conversations. Like, again, I think it goes back to what was talked about when this first started. It's the same conversations. And the biggest thing I pull from all that is, you know, whether you're technical, whether you're business, you know, a lot of that obviously depends on the organization you're in, the situation that you're in. But understanding the context around your situation, right? I mean, maybe you're a great CISO at a 10-person company, but not at a 100,000-person company. That's not your situation. And your requirements are going to be different. 10-person, you probably don't have a ton of people underneath you with the technical. You need that technical, right? It's a whole different story versus this other area where you're going to have those deputies. You're going to have the technical people to cover that side, you know, and help you get through that. So that biggest kind of theme that was going through there with everything was understanding your context. And I think it goes beyond, we always say business, right? It's like, oh, you have to speak the business. You have to, you know, understand your business. But as we, I think, kind of flush this out, like business includes legal. It includes these other pieces, you know, depending on the organization you're in, like it includes so much more than just saying, be smart with business. Or be smart with technical. Like, what does that even mean? I think Jim did a good job asking that question. Like, what is a technical discussion versus a non-technical discussion? There's no differentiator there, really. What you think is technical and I think are technical discussions may be completely different.
Yep. All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the next 100 bring. I'm not planning on killing this thing anytime soon. Yeah. So as Colin said, here's to the run up to 1,000.
Oh, was that 6 years down the road, 5 years down the road? I mean, it's
that's maybe more, a little more than that.
I mean, it's
a little more than that. I wonder if we can get to 1,000.
We're past halfway. We're past halfway. So
past halfway.
As we talked about, this is only 600 numbered episodes.
That's right.
Don't cheat ourselves. We've got a whole bunch of half episodes out there that aren't numbered. That exist.
Well, listen, for all of you guys that stuck around and that have listened for a while, that you're listening to this now, I want to say thank you because I feel privileged to do this every time we get fire up this mic and this app. I feel privileged to be able to talk to some of these amazingly intelligent people You know, James, you said it, we learn something new every single time we do this.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you saw, I mean, we see it, I think, in per episode basis, but it's usually one or two people. But, to get six people on that are discussing, it's like, I'm looking at the time and I'm like, I haven't said anything yet, but I don't have anything to add to this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they've got this covered.
I've been there.
You know, like, I'll, like, let, that's what we're here for, right? Is to get their side of things and share their stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just amazing to hear all the different aspects. And, you know, for me personally, I mean, being more of like a AppSec heavy, or at least in the past, been more of an AppSec heavy person, like having the exposure to all the different topics that we cover and the different people that we talk to and all the different areas has made a huge difference. You know, I think for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been huge. All right. Well, you guys, thanks for listening. Listen, we're going to keep this going. Check us, you know, subscribe into the YouTube channel so you can see the videos. You know, tell your friends about this podcast, on the RSS feed, on LinkedIn. You know, I get more access to guests as we grow, and that's what I really want. I want to grow this thing big enough to where enough people can hear some of these amazing guests that we get all the time, and that I'm privileged to have and call friends. If you can, I started a it's not a subscription thing, but like hey, if you wanted to buy us coffee at some point, there's now a way to. We still don't run ads. I don't plan on it. So you're not going to get that, but, maybe you've been thinking, hey, maybe I'd like to contribute in some way. Well, now you can. So go to dtsr.buzzsprout.com. Every episode has a link to that now. Give us a shot. We'd love to hear from you. And until 601, James, it's awesome. Let's do this again.
Yep. Absolutely. I can't wait.
All right, out we go. See you guys later.
Boop.
This is Bella. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave my dad a review and share this with your friends. Bye.